Let's get started with great to have you back, Pep.
Great to see you again, Nima.
Let's get started with what has happened to Scott Ritter. In your opinion, what the government, the Biden administration, trying to do to him? What's the reason behind this, in your opinion?
Well, intimidation and hardcore intimidation, which they excel in. In fact, they simply cannot admit that Scott, with his background, his institutional background, and the fact that he's an outspoken critic of the system because he knows the system very well from the inside, it's absolutely unbearable. So any excuse they have to harass him, they're going to use it. This was, let's say, the first outright flagrant message, in fact, like, you know, we have our sights on you, whatever you do, we are watching, so be careful. But Scott is not easily intimidated. That's a great thing. In fact, none of us independents, we are not intimidated by instances of power. We are basically doing our job as independent analysts, telling reality the way it is, telling it like it is to a global audience. And it's great to have a lot of young people included in this, especially global majority audience. And of course, there are some red lines. All of us, Scott especially, we have to be very careful not to by any means put on the public sphere what could be considered secret information and American national security information. It's what happened to Julian, and we all know what happened to Julian. Apart from that, we can do anything. And basically, Scott is hated by this particular administration and by sectors of the industrial military complex because he shows the absurdities of the forever wars, and especially when it comes to the proxy war in Ukraine, which is not a proxy war anymore. Now we should start talking directly about what it is. Now this is a direct war between the US and Russia, period. There's no proxy anymore. And considering that the okay was given for this absolutely stupid suicidal mission in Kursk, which was basically to harass, wound, and even kill civilians mostly, because there are no military installations in the Kursk, near the Kursk border. That's it, you know, now it's flagrant. This is the US and NATO's plan B. We always saw that they never had a plan B. Plan B, because they never thought they would need a plan B because they were sure they were going to win the proxy war. So this is their plan B, a war of terror, as I described it. And now it's a war of terror by the Americans and their vassals against Russia. And Scott is one of the foremost analysts describing it on a daily basis.
We've learned that the U.S. Defense Department spokesman, Patrick Ryder, he's talking about that they don't know what's the reason, what's the purpose of this attack on the part of Ukrainian on Kursk region. Do you believe that they're talking? Do they really think that people are so stupid they don't understand what's going on and the Ukrainians are not capable of doing any sort of operation without NATO, without the intelligence coming from the West?
I love the way you put it, Nima, because they actually think that we are all stupid. They actually think that the whole global South especially is stupid. This operation could never happen without an okay from Washington. Everybody knows that. It's not that this was a Zelensky whim or wet dream with the SBU guys the Azovists, you know, all sorts of banderistas, etc. No, 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 no. This needed a green light from Washington. Of course, and NATO advisors. So this proves to all of us, once again, the quality, the military and IQ quality of these advisors. You know, when you are already losing a war along a front line of 1,000 kilometers, you take some of your best troops and brigades to open a new front with no clear objective in sight. And your clear objective, if that ever was, is completely absurd, is to go inside Russian land for 60 kilometers and take over a nuclear power plant. And you don't have the resources, the weapons, and the manpower necessary to do that properly. So this is completely absurd. They were trying to change, once again, change the subject. What do American administrations and NATO especially do when they are on a losing streak? They change the subject, they change the narrative, which is exactly the case. So in the first day or two, of course, a lot of people in Russia were caught by surprise. There were red alarms everywhere. There were a lot of pessimistic analysis, including by military bloggers, respected military bloggers. And then people start to see the thing for what really was. And it's a very complex dynamic. And we still don't know how the whole thing happened previous to the incursion. And let's say during the first 24 hours. I got some mixed signals from my sources in Moscow. I'll be in Moscow in, I think, 2 weeks from now, max, you know. But as it stands, it's a mix of the Minister of Defense was caught napping, and they knew their intel was showing that this was going to happen, and they let it happen to set up a trap. So we can maneuver among these two, along these two possibilities, because it's probably a mix of both. Of course, the Minister of Defense was not paying too much attention to that border, because that border is not strategic. It was policed by a local police and the Guardia. There were no Russian troops on that border. And it was not very, very important in there, considering what's going on in the Donbass front, right? And at the same time, it's obvious, considering that Russia has an absolute mastery of the skies, they knew that something was afoot. If that's the case, there are two possibilities. One, they didn't pay too much attention to it, which is a serious problem as far as the top ranks of the Ministry of Defense are concerned. Or, okay, they took their noses, okay, let's see what they're going to do, and then we'll react accordingly. This is quite possible. The fact that they were that they might have been caught completely by surprise, if there is a smoking gun proving that, wow, this would require a total dismantling of the current structure of the Ministry of Defense. We're not there yet. On the other hand, another information that I got reconfirmed from yesterday to today. There are two people now in charge of what's going on in Kursk and around it. And it's not the Ministry of Defense anymore. It's not Gerasimov. And one of them is Bortnikov, the head of the FSB, because this is now a counter-terrorist operation. Really. The fact that the whole area now was put under a regime of counter-terrorist operation means that any Ukrainian over there is a terrorist, by definition, preferably killed. So preferably is the take no prisoners scenario, right? And of course, in military terms, we see that the whole situation is being relatively rearranged. And this we hear especially by the Akhmat Chechen commander, Which Apti, and Apti is quite something. He's the epitome of a badass, a Chechen badass commander. And what he has been saying is that, look, I think our mopping up is progressing. The leaders, the commanders of this whole operation, they're all dead. They attacked the rear, so the rear practically disappeared. So we have a cluster of Ukrainians in the middle, and they're going to be dealt with in a take no prisoners way, you know. So considering how credible he is, we can assume that this is the real situation on the ground. Nobody knows the real situation on the ground in detail. For instance, we still know that there are a lot of people already left. They were forced to leave. Almost 80,000 residents in the region, they were forced to leave. Some of them will be relocated to, for instance, parts of Donbas. Very, very interesting. So you are relocating Russians from parts of Russia to the new regions of Russia. It's fascinating in terms of an internal migration, you know. How this is going to play up in the next, let's say, week or 10 days is essential. So if the mopping up is finished in 10 days or so, the Russians are not transferring a huge amount of troops and material from Donbas. They are doing it with what's in the region and extra input, for instance, from Wagner, former Wagner, and from Chechens. So this is not destabilizing the Russian attacks on the front line by all means, you know. But we should have, I would say, within the next few weeks, a very good explanation of what really happened, especially solving this Minister of Defense caught napping possibility. And okay, let's let it happen, and then trap, and then we accelerate the debacle. For the moment, it's a mix of two, Nima. We don't have smoking guns anywhere. But the fact that this is now a counter-terrorist operation speaks already, I would say, volumes in terms of the Minister of Defense is not totally in charge anymore. I think this is the first, I would say, instance of things will be moving in that sphere, you know.
How does Russia see right now this operation? Do they really consider it as an invasion on the part of NATO, or they're seeing that it's Ukrainian at the end of the day? Politically, I'm talking about.
Right. The signs are there. They're not considering it as a, let's say, a frontal NATO assault. They are trying to dismiss it. And the way Putin referred to it, in fact, in his own words, this was very interesting because he linked it directly to ceasefire negotiations. He said, how can you have a ceasefire when you have the Ukrainians in a provocation like that attacking civilians and a nuclear power plant? In this case, what happened to Zaporizhzhia, not to the Kursk power plant. And we can also, we can even extrapolate from what he said and apply it to Gaza. How can we have peace negotiations and a ceasefire in Gaza when the genocide continues and Israelis are also bombing sovereign nations such as Syria practically every day? So this is the new logic that Putin is, in a very diplomatic way, this is already circulating among all the major capitals in the global south. Exactly. How are we going to deal with these lunatics, genociders, these freaks, and these neo-Nazis? The only way to deal with these people is militarily. And this is what Russia is doing now at the moment. Okay, let's mop up, and if we need to, let's kill all the Ukrainians involved. But then the second part is, okay, how we're going to deal with the big picture, which is, this is the new American NATO strategy, a war of terror against Russia, just as the Israeli strategy in West Asia is a war of terror, including a genocidal against the Palestinians.
Is the Ukrainian army getting to the point that we can say that they're not capable of doing any sort of important and substantial operation on the battlefield? That's why they're attacking these civilians, these part that are not part of the battlefield, that maybe this was one of their master plan for this power plant in Kursk region. And they tried a lot for the Zaporizhia power plant. They failed to capture that. And right now, at the same time, they were attacking Zaporizhia as well. And right now, this attack on the Kursk region is one of their final desperate movement toward Russia, because they want something big. They want something, some attack. Maybe they want an emotional attack on the part of Russia on civilians in Ukraine, which we know that's not possible, because the way that Russia is operating is not possible. But it seems that the army in Ukraine is not any more capable of continuing this conflict. That's why they're attacking these civilians.
Essentially, that's it, Nima. It's a sort of, how we call it in American football, a Hail Mary pass. Absolutely. When you know that you're losing the game, and only the Hail Mary can help you win the game. Yeah. This is the situation that they are at the moment, because the debacle all across the 1,000-kilometer long front line on an everyday basis is massive. The number of killed and wounded is tens of tens and tens of thousands. And this is not going to change in the next few months. It's going to accelerate, in fact. The talk about a ceasefire, assuming this would be, assuming a lot of, let's assume, no? The first thing we'll be assuming would be Trump wins the election. He's already promised that he's going to sit down with Putin and they're going to discuss a ceasefire in the end of the war. If the Americans propose a ceasefire, the Russians have to be in an extremely strong position to even think about negotiating, assuming that they will negotiate, because what Trump is going to propose is going to be risible, according to everything that leaked already about his possible proposal, right? So in the next 3 months, the front could credibly collapse all along. That's one possible scenario. So what would Kiev have to negotiate? They already don't have much. First of all, because there's nothing to negotiate, because Putin already established the parameters for the negotiation. So who is going to negotiate? That's issue number two. Probably not Zelensky, because even the Americans want to finally throw him under the bus. And it's no wonder that there's this crazy circulation for the past 2-3 days already of Zelensky's successor. That guy, former Minister of Interior, Ossetian Armenian, born in Baku, very close to the Azov Battalion. So it's going to be another fascist gangster, in fact, but easily manipulated by the Americans, because obviously now they think, no, that's it. We cannot have this two-bit actor anymore. He doesn't serve the purpose anymore. And Zelensky knows that, obviously. He's not a fool. He may be a clown, but he's not a fool. And he knows that his days are numbered. So he was counting on trying to sell something to his sponsors. Look at our fabulous incursion in Russia. We are taking Russian territory. We're establishing ourselves in Russian territory. Obviously, now that the whole thing is going down, can you imagine the repercussions after a few weeks from now? In fact, next month, we can have a completely different situation. It's quite possible. So this is where we are at the moment. A collapse of the front, a Hail Mary that doesn't work, and a leader that doesn't lead anymore and is about to be thrown overboard. So it's a lot of imponderables at the same time, right? And for the Russians, nothing is an imponderable. Everything is carefully mapped out. They have their strategy. They are not deviating from their strategy. It is working. We know how a Russian war of attrition works. All the best military specialists, unbiased military specialists, independent, all across the global South know how this thing is developing. It's not going to change. And there's nothing left for that gang of psychopaths, neo-Nazis, Azovist, Banderistas in Kiev than trying terror tactics or throwing every day an avalanche of drones against Russia, which they keep on doing. And this is still very, very dangerous. Every day, Russian installations are hit by a volley of Ukrainian drones nonstop. This is very, very, very dangerous. And it's very hard to police such an enormous border, not only in the new regions in Russia, but the Russian mainland as well.
The other thing would be this new agreement between that Shoigu announced that they're going to send weapons to Serbia. And we know that there is a lot of protests, in the large protests in Serbia against some companies, and they're not happy with this situation. But in your opinion, we see Serbia, we see Hungary, Slovakia. On the other hand, we see Germany and German newspaper, and they're talking about German tanks on Russian soil again.
Yeah,
this is huge. When this concept coming out of the Bild, a very famous publication in Germany, they're talking about this. And do you understand that what Russia is trying to do in order to respond to this type of policy on the part of mostly Western Europeans?
Well, the problem is NATO, the Americans, NATO as a whole, and the American generals at NATO, they interpret Russian non-reaction or sometimes partial reaction to all these provocations as weakness. So sooner or later, and this is now a serious debate in Moscow itself. As long as there is not a very, very serious graphic Russian response to all these provocations, like really hitting command centers in the West, these people will keep upping the ante and trespassing red line after red line. The problem is two problems. First of all, this is not the way Putin thinks. This is not the way the Security Council in Moscow thinks and projects what will be a very, very long war. Don't forget that this is the beginning of a long war between Russia and the US NATO. These are just the first chapters, you know. And second, they know that if they react to these provocations, the obvious result that everybody knows, even a Tuareg in the middle of the Sahara knows, it's a direct confrontation against NATO with absolutely unforeseen consequences. So the Russians don't want that. The Russian strategy is essentially patience, calculation, adaptation to problems. They learn a lot from their mistakes in the SMO. The fact that now it's not an SMO anymore, now it is really a counter-terrorist operation on a massive scale. Because for all practical purposes, Putin this week declared Kiev as a terrorist entity. So he has to follow up on that. And the fact that he got the head of the FSB to supervise everything that is happening in Kursk. So there is already a change of paradigm here. It is a gigantic counter-terrorist operation. And we still don't know how they are going to reorganize their modus operandi. The battlefield, what's going on in Novorossiya, that's not going to change. But what's going to change is conceptually what kind of war Russia is fighting. It's not a special military operation anymore. That was the past, you know. So sooner or later, I would say that the leadership in Moscow has to send a clear signal, especially to those NATO fanatics, that look, you think that you are playing with us, you think that you're not going to respond to your provocations. Okay, here's a signal. And this is just a signal. So this is something that could happen, let's say, until the American elections, what, 3 months from now. Or the Russians may expect to see what's going to happen in November and who, what kind of administration they're going to have to deal with. And in 2025, they're going to have their first signal sent to the new American administration. But they're extremely patient. And Putin and the Security Council as a whole, they see this as a very, very long war. And that's another, just like the Chinese see the confrontation with the US as a very, very long confrontation that could last decades. So we're just at the initial stages of these two confrontations, right?
We have your...
The story of the 21st century, Nima.
Yeah. We are witnessing two different attitudes coming from Russia and coming from the United States. On one side, we see, despite having a great war, a war of attrition that we haven't seen before in the aftermath of the World War II between Russia and NATO. And despite having this, Russia is seeking any all the means that it has in his hand to do diplomacy in the Middle East, in the European Union, right now Mali, and you see Vietnam and all these countries, they're trying to talk with all of these countries. On the other hand, you see the United States just helping, sending, in the case of Israel, you see they're sending more weapons, more aids, just to kill more civilians. And yes, right now in Ukraine, the same kind of policy. Do you think that the United States is losing its sense of having a mindset of diplomacy? Because diplomacy has been done. It seems that the Biden administration doesn't know what's diplomacy anymore.
Absolutely correct, Nima. And in fact, diplomacy for them is threats and a tsunami of sanctions. This is what diplomacy is for this administration. The previous administration with Trump and with Pompeo as Secretary of State was not very much different. It also included targeted assassinations as well. With General Soleimani, tsunami of sanctions against China. So it doesn't change. This is bipartisan. And this is the American elites as a whole. The American establishment, old money, the old families, the invisible families and money behind the big three, especially BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, especially Vanguard. The people who run the show, the people who meet at private dinners at the Harvard Club in New York City. These are the kind of people. Nobody would ever see them because this is very, very private. And then they send their emissaries around the world, Bilderberg. You know, these are the emissaries. The people who really run the show, they don't show up in public, period. And they are scared. They are scared because of the trillions in debt. They are scared because the international financial system could collapse from one day to another with that pyramid of derivatives. They are scared that even the war that they want in West Asia, in the first day or in the first 3 or 4 days, could collapse them all. One single thing that might happen. Iran closes the Strait of Hormuz, which they can do like this. This is the collapse of the international financial system. This is a barrel of oil at 200, 300, 400, 500, even more. And the pyramid of derivatives collapse. The whole thing collapses. You know, So they are scared, they are afraid, and they have nothing to offer the absolute majority of the planet, the global majority, 88% of the planet. They offer threats, sanctions, and color revolutions and hybrid war. This is what we're seeing in front of us. Example, the color revolution in Bangladesh, it worked. It was very, very easy. They interfered marginally, but with just enough power and pressure to destabilize a government. So this means that they can do this anywhere they want across the global south. And it's very dangerous in Bangladesh because it's a color revolution targeting two BRICS. So two BRICS will be losing out of a government infiltrated by the Americas or outright controlled by the Americas, India and China, for different reasons. They tried a color revolution here in Thailand. Didn't work. Today, as I'm talking to you, the current government in Thailand just fell a few hours ago. For other reasons, very complicated internal Thai politics, because and this the current prime minister basically is one of the clones, one of the vassals of the former prime minister Thaksin. But the Americas, they will keep trying a color revolution in Thailand because they want Thailand to cut off its very close relationship with China. So Thailand is crucial in Southeast Asia for the Americas. Myanmar, the Americas, the CIA is investing in destabilizing Myanmar from the inside, getting money to different tribes and ethnic groups who are at war with the Burmese in Yangon. So, you know, this is what they know. We all know how good they are in hybrid war and color revolutions. This is what they are offering the global majority. Tsunami of sanctions, we all know about it, of course. And of course, when it comes to the forever wars, they are concentrating on the two major ones, Israel, Gaza, and Ukraine. And they know that they are losing both at the same time, which gets them even more frightened. So that's why, as hostages of this whole setup, for all of us, the situation is extremely critical. I'll give one example of how critical it is in terms of the Iranian response to the assassination of Haniyeh in Tehran, and of course the axis of resistance response to the assassination of the top Hezbollah commander Shukr in Beirut, and all of these two together. Why nothing happened for the past 2 weeks? Because the equation that the leadership in Tehran and the axis of resistance, the people they are talking to, Hezbollah, the Houthis, Ansarullah Houthis, the Hashdal Shabi, the militias in Iraq, how are we going to have a response that teaches a lesson to those genocidals in Tel Aviv, but at the same time stops at the border of the whole thing degenerating into a regional war? So all of us, we can see how difficult this equation is for the Iranians, for Hezbollah, for the Houthis, etc. As much as they are ready to inflict serious pain on Israel, and they have the military means to do so, this has to be so, you know, meticulously calibrated that it doesn't degenerate into a regional war. And the acting foreign minister of Iran, Bagheri Khani, he's very, very good, very competent diplomat. He just said that a few days ago, I think at the end of last week. We're working very hard not to give to the Israelis what they really want, which is a regional war. So the Iranian diplomats, for them, it's very, very clear what has to be done. You know, but of course, the final decision comes from the Supreme Leader, the IRGC, and of course, talking to the military commanders of the Axis of Resistance. So this is a very, very complicated decision. And we all depend on what they're going to decide. Even if, and I would say that would be even more crafty in terms of a decision. Okay, they decide to postpone indefinitely the response, and they leave the Israelis and the Americans like headless chickens, as they are now. War of nerves nonstop, because it's a mix of psyops, strategic ambiguity, and war of nerves, essentially. Okay, you're going to be waiting game. You're going to be waiting. We're going to attack, but I'm not going to tell you when. And you don't know when we're going to attack. So obviously, Americans are desperate. The Europeans are desperate. The Israelis are desperate. The bunkers. Oh, let's find a solution. Let's come up with some sort of ceasefire in Gaza. No, they can't, because Netanyahu himself, he imposed new conditions early this week to the negotiations, which were supposed to be this Thursday. The Qataris and the Egyptians said, look, we have almost everything we need. Hamas said they are coming. Netanyahu comes with another set of conditions, and Hamas yesterday said, no, we're not going. No way. We didn't agree to that. Obviously, because Netanyahu doesn't want a ceasefire. He wants a perpetual war, and he wants a bigger war to drag the Americans. The objective of these provocations is basically a bigger war against Hezbollah and Iran, especially Iran, but dragging the Americans to fight the war for them, Israelis. And everybody in West Asia knows about this. So how you're going to deal with these fanatics? So this is the number one extreme problem, probably the number one extreme problem in the world right now. How you have a bunch of rational political actors to deal with a bunch of total apocalyptic fanatics that are taking the whole region, West Asia, and the rest of the world hostage. That's where we are.
Yeah. And here comes the Russia's policy toward the conflict in the Middle East. Mahmoud Abbas was in Russia. I don't know if he's still in Russia, but he says that Russia must be part of any sort of negotiations in the Middle East, which is so important. We were talking about why Mahmoud Abbas, why Putin is trying to meet, but we know that Mahmoud Abbas is on the opposite part of this convoy. He's mostly in favor of Israel. What's going on? But right. It's important to have both sides when you try to negotiate. And it's coming out of the mouth of Mahmoud Abbas that Russia must be part of negotiations. It's important. And
that's, yes, Nima, this is very important because this is Russia-China. Don't forget that China got everybody from Palestine, 14 factions, to come to Beijing, pledge that they're going to work together for a united Palestine, stop with all their internal squabbling, and then they have full support from the part of the Chinese. Very, very important. They signed the declaration, which brings us once again to another very, very important subtext of what happened, considering the Israeli response. Only a few days after Haniyeh was among these 14 factions in Beijing signing the Beijing Declaration about unity of Palestine, he was assassinated in Tehran. From a Chinese point of view, I cannot even begin to tell you and all of us, our audience, how extremely angry this got the Chinese, because the Chinese interpreted as a slap on their face directly by Israel. They are promoting peace, including Hamas, the number one negotiator for a possible ceasefire. And a few days later, he's assassinated by the other party. So the Chinese, they never forget stuff like that. Never. So they are working much closer now these past few days, not only in terms of supporting Palestine, but supporting the Iranian response when it comes. By the way, on Monday, Bagheri, Kani, and Wang Yi, they were on the phone. What they were talking about? Exactly what we are talking about now. And the Chinese saying, look, whatever you do in terms of respecting your national interests and your sovereignty, we support you. This is enormous coming from China. Enormous, enormous. And on the Russians, to see how Russia and China work together. Now, visit of Mahmoud Abbas, same thing. He sits down with Putin. Putin says, look, we have our own war, which is true. Our priority is the war that we have here, which is for us is an existential war. But we are paying attention to your war as well. And what came up out of this meeting, which is something that I see as groundbreaking. Guess who's going to be invited for the BRICS summit in Kazan in October? Palestine. How absolutely cool is that? This is a major Russian diplomatic victory. And Abbas himself, the Russians didn't say anything. They let Abbas speak for Palestine. And Abbas was saying, look, we discussed BRICS. We like the fact that all BRICS members have sympathy and empathy for Palestine. So we agreed that we should maybe have a special meeting during the BRICS forum in Kazan dedicated to Palestine. It's what the BRICS call outreach sections, when they have BRICS discussions with countries that are not part of the BRICS 10. Fascinating. So this is practically settled. They're going to settle the modalities in the next few weeks or so. So can you imagine, Nima, the optics of having Palestine officially represented at the most important BRICS summit of them all, chaired by Russia, to discuss Palestinian issues? This is enormous, enormous. So this, in terms of diplomacy, this is absolutely outstanding. So diplomacy is going much faster, of course, than, of course, the tragedy on the ground in Gaza. But we have some signs of hope like this one, you know.
Yeah. And when it comes to Iran and the response to this assassination of two important leaders, one in Iran and the other one outside Iran, it seems that at the end of the day, Iran has to respond to this type of activity on the part of Israelis, because they're getting out of hand. They're doing a lot of things that, because there has to be some sort of limits for what they're doing. They cannot do each and everything they want to do. They were accusing Gazans of raping, of killing civilians. They're doing all those things that they were accusing Gazans of doing. Mm-hmm. If Iran just not respond to them, that I think they think that they can get away with everything they do in the future.
Exactly. Exactly. It comes back to our point. How to teach them a lesson without this thing turning into a regional war and an apocalyptic war. But that everybody agrees there must be a response. And another fact, Nima, very, very important. The fact that Hamas is saying that they are not going to this negotiating table on Thursday, the Americans, the Egyptians, and the Qataris would be there. It's one of the conditions that the Iranians themselves had already established. Look, we are not going to respond to what Israel did on one condition, that there are meaningful ceasefire negotiations and Hamas will be there. So now Hamas already said, we're not going. So this frees Iran completely to respond now, because they know, not only Hamas knows, but Hezbollah knows, Iran knows, everybody, the Axis of Resistance, everybody, and other Arab players know that Netanyahu basically torpedoed these negotiations with a new set of exigencies, let's put it this way. So now the coast is clear. And so we go back to the same point, Nima. When it's going to be and how.
Yeah.
And, of course, the war of nerves. So now we have, as I put it, the Persians playing Sun Tzu, proving once again that the Persians read and totally understood Sun Tzu. War of nerves, strategic ambiguity, psyops. This is exactly what they're doing now. And it's driving the other side completely nuts. They can keep doing this for weeks if they want. And it's helpful because the Israeli economy is imploding as we speak. We have everything from non-functioning ports to people, you know, stocking up on mineral water, to people going to bunkers, to people that don't know what to do, war of nerves, people waking up at night, you name it. It's working. It's working very, very well. And Khamenei, if I'm not mistaken, today, Khamenei said something about psyops. So obviously, you know, this comes straight from Khamenei. Always, okay, let's apply a little bit of psyops on these guys and let's derail them psychologically completely. And then we do something, which proves that this might take a while still.
We know that at the end of the day, whatever they're going to do, there has to be some improvement on the situation with Gaza, because the whole situation, the whole importance that we are still talking about, Iran, Israel, and the region, is Gazans that are getting killed, getting murdered by Israelis. And that's why I think that Iran is so... they're thinking the way that they come to a solution to help Gazans at the end of the day. This is important. And we know that the Arab League is... not totally, but somehow in line with what Iran is talking about.
Yes, but not all of them, Nima. We know that. We have, that little king of Jordan, he's essentially a coward and a traitor. And Sisi is a double agent, diplomatically. And obviously, Saudi Arabia and UAE, they don't do anything. They're totally passive. So this is terrible. It's absolutely terrible. And it's not only Gazans, Nima. It's the people in the West Bank and the people in East Jerusalem as well. You saw what happened early this week. You have a bunch of bloody fanatics led by that absolutely unspeakable Israeli minister invading Al-Aqsa Mosque, in fact. Once again, an enormous provocation. And coming back to the key factor in internal Israeli politics, which very few people in the West, Alistair Crook is probably the platinum standard that called everyone's attention to that. And apart from Alistair, I haven't seen anybody get into the detail. The fact that an eschatological cult, in fact, has taken this current Netanyahu government hostage, basically controls the war cabinet, controls all Israeli policies, and they are supported by 800,000 settlers armed to their teeth. Totally fanatical. Question number one and final question. How are you going to deal with 800,000 armed to the teeth apocalyptic fanaticals? There's no other way apart from the obvious. There's got to be a military way to get rid of these people. But how? And how are you going to do this? Without endangering people who live in Gaza, in West Bank, and in East Jerusalem. There's no answer for that. And there's no answer by the Axis of Resistance, by the BRICS who support the Axis of Resistance. Nobody has an answer for this equation for the moment. This is how serious it gets, you know. You can get, okay, get rid of Netanyahu. That's very easy. Then he goes to jail. Who's going to be next? Probably somebody representing these 800,000 fanatics. So, you know, the ball keeps on rolling. The toxic ball keeps on rolling. There's no issue for this drama unless a war, unless a military operation. But how to organize this military operation and how not to have Palestinians as a whole, as victims in such a military operation, you know, no answer.
Two important players in the conflict, Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, as you mentioned, is so, their attitude is so tricky. But we know that they're important. And that deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia that China and Russia tried to do is playing a very important role right now. Because at the end of the day, we know Saudis were so hesitant in attacking Houthis. They didn't participate in that operation. And right now, they have some economical connections, not some lot of economical connection with the United States. That's why the United States has a lot of leverage on them. And they can manipulate their policy. But at the end of the day, Iran and Saudi Arabia are so important to be together, to be so connected in order to have to achieve something in Gaza. Without right now, it seems that the United States, by sending the Biden administration, has decided to sell weapons, military equipment, again to Saudi Arabia, because they're trying to convince them that we're going to be with you, you're going to be with us, and your future is with us. This is the problem right now in the Middle East. They have to, these countries, Iran and Saudi Arabia, they have to understand that their future is not separated, it's together. They have to build the future together in the Middle East.
You're right, Nima. And Iran already understood that even before they were invited and became a full BRICS member. Saudi Arabia, they're still sitting on the fence. It's more than obvious. Nobody knows what MBS really wants. Obviously, he wants very good relations with both Russia and China. He is not against a reapproximation with Iran, but let's say carefully, slowly. He doesn't care about Palestine at all. And the relationship with the US depends a lot on the next administration. If it's Trump 2.0, relations with MBS will be absolutely swimming, of course, and deals, etc. And of course, Trump will keep, you know, seducing MBS to the American, I wouldn't say vision, but to the American way of doing things, right? Including, you need zillions of dollars in weapons, no problem. After all, it's a very good business for the American industrial military complex, especially, right? But this will, I would say that the summits in Kazan in October, where they're going to be on the same table, will go a long way to show to MBS which way the wind is blowing, really. And he may learn a few things out of it. And he'll have a chance to compare what he learns in Kazan with the G20 in November in Rio, where the main BRICS are going to be there, and also the G7 inside the G20. So let's say MBS has 2 months to make up his mind, essentially. And it's essential that his decision is crucial for the global majority. Not only in terms of GCC, in terms of Arab League, in terms of regional policies in West Asia, but for the lands of Islam as a whole and for the global majority. And now he's not, he's not a fool. He may be misguided on and off, but he's not a fool. and he will see what's really best for Saudi Arabia. And he will also see that depending on what he does, he will become an enemy for the American establishment. So he has to be ready to deal with that as well, to carry this weight. Will he do it? That's another cliffhanger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, Pepe.
Okay.
How do you find the? We talk about Iran, Saudi Arabia, important, and the other player is the new political leadership of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar. How do you find him, and how do you see his policies, and is he going to be the same way that Ismail Haniyeh was, or he's going to change the attitude of Hamas?
Let's say he'll be even more realist, because he knows Israel from the inside, which very, very few people in Palestine do. In fact, very few people in West Asia do. He does, from the inside. So he knows, you know, where to attack and how to tweak their weaker points as well. And at the same time, he can sell himself as a true representative of all Palestinians. Apparently, I don't have this confirmed yet. All across Palestine, Sinwar is now seen as the real top leader of Palestine, not only the new leader of Hamas. He's not blamed for what happened after October 7. He's trusted by the absolute majority of the population, and he's trusted by the absolute majority of Palestinians to defend the interests of people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, and in Gaza. So, you know, his political capital is enormous. And I'm sure he's clever enough to know how to use it. Absolutely. And I'm sure the Israelis are trembling because this is a worthy adversary. I would say, in terms of stature and in terms of inner power, much more formidable than Haniyeh. And of course, the problem is, will the West talk to him? Will the Americans talk to him? Will the Europeans talk to him? That's another story. But in terms of legitimacy, he is the new guy in town, definitely. Much more than Mahmoud Abbas. Mahmoud Abbas is the past. Mahmoud Abbas is basically controlled by the West. Mahmoud Abbas' credibility in Palestine is less than 10%. So this is the direct comparison. So the Russians and the Chinese, who are supporting Palestine, you know, with deeds and with diplomacy, etc., they have to be behind Sinwar as well. And I'm sure they will. Of course, in a more, much more diplomatic way, of course, not antagonizing the other, just like Beijing did. They called all the factions to sign the Beijing Declaration. So they're going to support everybody in Palestine. But you need a leader. And the leader coming from the grassroots and up, it's Sinwar. There's no question about that.
Yeah. Muito obrigado, Pepe. Grande Thank prazer, you. Como sempre.
Thank you. Enormous pleasure, Nima. Thank you. Thank you.
Have a very good time.
Cheers.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
See you soon. Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.